listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Father Tim Grumbach is in studio with me again this week. We missed you, Father Tim.
It's so good to be back. It feels like it's been a little while.
Now, you just came off of a huge ordination this past week. How many priests were ordained in Los Angeles County, or diocese?
We had six priests ordained for the Archdiocese, which is a good number. It's about where we've been over the last few years, and we're keeping up. We're keeping up.
That's awesome. Very hopeful. For so many of the young priests, I find that they've kind of gone through that generation of kind of some of the challenges in the seminaries, challenges in the priesthood, and you're seeing just, I think, a revival in a lot of the young priests today, kind of 40 and under.
There's certainly a purification happening in the priesthood right now, and to even speak of a general priesthood without speaking of the priests individually, when we look at the priests individually, we see some very holy men. And so we can speak of a wounded priesthood, or we could speak of a reviving priesthood. But when you look at the individuals, we're seeing a lot of holiness, which is a great thing to see.
It's such a godsend to see, especially at a time that is so heartbreaking with the scandals that we've come out. And, you know, I think so many of us tend to commit a little bit of a fallacy in confusing, you know, the part with the whole, and like there's one bad priest, there's one bad bishop, or we could say there are a lot of bad priests and a lot of bad bishops. But then that somehow takes away from all the good priests and bishops that we have.
And to speak of the church that way is, a lot of people will say the church has failed, but really it's, you know, individuals within the church, individuals within the institution. So we've got to speak about specifics rather than just overgeneralize things. And then we can look at the holiness within each person and see what God is doing in each individual soul and how he is, you know, saving the world through these individuals rather than just this generic amorphous organization.
And we have to be careful not to become overly emotional about it. Sometimes it's so easy to just be angry at those priests. And, you know, it's a logical fallacy on our part, but it's also driven by emotion if we just lump them all together. Coming up on the show today, we'll be talking later on about the importance of living in a state of grace. What does that mean, and why is it so important for the Catholic journey? What can we do to cooperate in God's mercy and grace and live a life of true, authentic charity? We'll also be talking about what I find is incredibly controversial, and that is Game of Thrones and how, you know, Father Tim, I love books. And I tried watching, or actually I never watched Game of Thrones because I knew just by research what was in it. I never watched it. What I did is I tried to read the books, and that we'll get into a little later. I just found it not something that we could really condone in terms of television watching, but the seasons are now over. The show has come to a close, and we're going to talk a little bit about it moving forward. We'll also be talking about how priests are looking at being forced to break the seal of the confessional here in the state of California, and some strong responses to some of the pro-abortion arguments you might be seeing in the country taking place right now. So, Father Tim, let's start for a second with some of this crazy gender ideology arguments. Here are some of the talking points you might hear. There's a man who identifies as a woman and now is a world-renowned supermodel. His name, he goes by Gina, I believe I'm saying it correctly, Rochero. And essentially, he has come out talking about the fact that, you know, we can't say anymore that gender is an immutable fact. We can say, however, that it's fluid, complex, and mysterious. And he also talks about, among other things, really just this idea of breaking free. I want to break down some of these talking points a little bit.
Absolutely. The idea of it being immutable and mysterious, and that there's a certain constriction that comes with it, we would almost agree on a lot of that. You know, well, certainly we would say it's immutable, and they want to disregard that. But most certainly, gender is mysterious because it comes from the plan and the heart of God, that he didn't just accidentally will this as a part of who we are, but it's a part of his, you know, divine and perfect will is our gender. But also to break free, what are they asking to break free from? And they're sensing a sort of constraint. A sort of constraint that comes with being gendered. And I would say exactly is that there is a constraint, but it's within the will of God that there is a difference between male and female, and there's meant to be a constraint there. And so they're seeking a sort of freedom from that, which is a dangerous word to use.
Right. And I know that people separated out sex is, you know, they've kind of given ground and said, okay, sex, yeah, is what you're born with, but gender is what you identify as. Mm-hmm. Sex is sex is sex. Who you are is ingrained by biological sex. And the reality is our biological sex that we all have to agree about is how we are born is functional. And the reality is that I'm finding a lot of people who are experiencing gender identity dysphoria and so forth. And a lot of these people say, well, I have so much pleasure engaging with people, let's say, of the same sex. Well, yeah, those certain body parts might be extremely pleasurable in engagement. However, they have a functional purpose.
Right. It comes back down to natural law, not necessarily that the laws of nature, those are two separate things, but understanding natural law that everything that's created is created towards its own end, its own purpose. Right. And then when we look at our human sexuality and deny the reality of natural law, deny the reality that there is a purpose for which our sexuality is created, then that is a breaking free from the beautiful and willed constraints that God has given to us.
The purpose of functionality is good, but as you talked about before, you know, in Gina Roquero's comments about how it's mysterious, in a sense, it's so true because love is complex. The function of the body parts, the anatomy is one thing. The ability to achieve having a baby through pregnancy is another. But the reality is that human love is so complex. And in fact, it's a mysterious transcendence of the human person that goes beyond something we can fully understand.
And it leads me to wonder in what sense this person is using the term mysterious. And I imagine that this culture wants to use it in a relativist sort of way where a mystery means I get to decide the meaning rather than there is a depth to it that I cannot fully reach. Mm-hmm. But rather, if it's mysterious, that means I can decide for myself with this absolute independence what it means.
But isn't that so wrong? As you're saying, mystery is something that out of bounds from what we can fully determine on our own. It means it's transcendent. It goes beyond us. You take this, Father Tim, look at this. And you guys are listening to Trending. For those who are just joining us, I'm Timmery. This attitude also from this man who identifies as a woman, Gina Roquero, as a model, says, you know, talks about breaking free. He's done a number of TED Talks now and talks about essentially, you know, when I look at this attitude of breaking free and how, you know, there's this courage now and being able to talk about the experience, what are you breaking free from? You know, freedom is ultimately a good, not, or freedom is meant to seek after something, not run away from something. Freedom is the ability to do good. That's why we believe we're free as human beings just by our creation. And the reality is that we can't break free from the reality of, let's say, our fertility. Women have tried to from the sexual liberation, you know, 60 years ago. And we see satisfactory among women has plummeted. And we're seeing the same thing in the transgender community.
Right. And they're using freedom in the sense of this radical autonomy that one decides for themselves the meaning of their humanity, the meaning of their sexuality. I think that goes back all the way to, is it Casey versus Planned Parenthood, where the Supreme Court defined, you know, a human's freedom by, you know, defining their own reality, defining their world and the universe around them. And it's this radical autonomy that no human being can give to another, let alone a Supreme Court in a political sphere. But this sense of freedom, of radical autonomy, rather than the freedom to do what one ought to.
Let's bring this to the news over the last couple of weeks. You know, June, as many know, is celebrated among the LGBTQ community as Gay Pride Month. Now, right at the beginning of June, Bishop Tobin of Rhode Island actually put out a tweet essentially saying, you know, you should not celebrate or attend any gay pride type of events, and saying that, you know, it goes against the moral and religious law and that this is actually harmful for children.
Mm-hmm. Very strong language. And if I remember correctly, I believe he sent the same tweet out this time last year and got some flack for it, but nothing like he did just over these last few days.
The response over Twitter has been rather intense, leading to a little bit of, not even, he put out a press statement that wasn't an apology, but it was an acknowledgement of the love for people still who experience same-sex attraction. He's like, he never says, I'm sorry, you know, it dismays me that you guys are having, you know, this response, but he stands firm and thanks people for supporting him.
That's right. And my honest perspective about this tweet is that while he was defending the truth that the church is teaching. And as a bishop, that is his role, and that's his vocation, to be a shepherd to his people, to present right teaching. But it's had me reflecting over the last few days about the role that a bishop can play in the very lives, in the trenches of the lives of his people. And in a way, I see this tweet as a little less helpful than I'm sure that he was hoping for it to be, truth as though he was speaking. But I don't see a bishop, any bishop, really able to be in the lives of their people as one needs to be in order to be able to say things like this in the way that he said it. So I don't disagree with him, but I've been thinking so much about the role of the laity in being welcoming to people in order to bring them into the church, in order to be able to hear this kind of language in a way that they're prepared to hear it.
I understand your perspective. So you're saying the truth, the tweet is there, but you're thinking that maybe it wasn't helpful. Here's the thing. I think so many of our bishops have been so wishy-washy on these issues that when there is actually authentic truth being communicated, people are hungry for that. However, I hear what you're saying, that maybe it wasn't necessarily helpful for people who are experiencing same-sex attraction. But at the same time, I think of people like Daniel Mattson, who say, you know, I'm so thankful that the church has been very clear and simple in expressing that you're called to a chaste lifestyle, and such actions are what are rejected, not the person.
Right, absolutely. And so what this tweet is doing for all of us, for those of us priests who are in the parishes, and all of the lay people who are, you know, the life of the parish, is we've got to be prepared now to welcome and receive the people and invite the people into our parishes and into our liturgical life as best as they are prepared, in a way so that they can receive this teaching now.
My two cents are, I appreciate the tweet, I appreciate the honesty of it, but I could see where sometimes a social media post might necessarily not always be the best place to make such bold statements every time.
Right.
Timmery will be right back. Send her a tweet at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Back in for a second here on the Bishop Tobin tweet. For those who are just joining us, Father Tim Grumbach of St. Augustine Parish in Los Angeles is with us. And we're talking about how Bishop Tobin put out a very clear tweet. You call it a little heavy-handed and saying, you know, we cannot, you know, calling Catholics, you cannot participate in or celebrate LGBTQ events, which we 100% agree with. It goes against the morality and the faith of the Catholic Church. And he adds this part, which I want to get into. He adds that it's essentially harmful for children. This is where I actually think his purpose was in sending out this tweet, because we're seeing some really majorly prominent movie stars and people who claim to be Catholic or putting, you know, that billboard face of, I'm this person, I'm also Catholic. And yet we see them at these LGBTQ pride parades and with their whole families. And I think that that's where the confusion lies. And I think that was a little bit more of the purpose of the bishop's tweet here, actually.
Yeah, and one of the most violent pushbacks, general pushbacks against this tweet would be people just generalizing and saying, well, actually, the Catholic Church is the worst place for children these days.
Right.
And we must fight back against that sentiment as well, because while there is a lot of evidence over the last half of a year, a little bit, almost a year now, of, you know, a lot of this, these stories coming about violence and abuse and sexual abuse against children in the Catholic Church, and it would be easy for someone to hear that on social media and said, oh yeah, of course, the Catholic Church is the worst place for children. But I can tell you, as a priest in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, to see what the Archdiocese has done over the last 20 years to protect children, there is no other organization doing as much as the Church is. So I would say the Catholic Church right now actually is the safest place for children, even though I want to be honest here, and I don't want to overstep my bounds, but it may be a lot safer for children than it is for priests right now to be in the Catholic Church.
And I know a lot of people aren't going to like to hear that, but the reality is if an accusation is made today against one of our priests, he is immediately removed from public duty, and it's very, very likely right now that he will never be able to practice his priestly ministry again. That's kind of the status quo that's being set across the nation. You just might not be hearing these stories. And I want to come back, because we can't ignore, you guys, we fully recognize the harm that has been done to thousands of people across this nation, especially, you know, prior to the 2000s, but even after, over the years, has been atrocious and is unacceptable. And the church is really working to make sure that there are higher levels of accountability. And the reality is we still have, and not saying this is a justification, but statistically lower realms of abuse within the church than you have in other large institutions such as school system.
Yeah, that's right. And understanding the monetary cost that it would be for the state of California and the public school system, if they open the statute of limitations against public school teachers and those who work at public schools, is that it's pretty clear that they do not want to open that up because of the cost to the state. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking in the realm of billions and billions of dollars it would cost the state if all of these cases were to be settled in the same way that they're demanding of the Catholic Church. And again, we're not discounting the real suffering and the need for healing. And I don't mean to say that, it's dangerous for a priest to be in the Catholic Church as if we're the victims here. I don't mean that by any stretch of the imagination. But I just want to point out how much safer it is in the Catholic Church for our children than it ever has been, and it is in almost any other organization. And it's really a whole lot easier just to get on social media and to fight back against something that Bishop Tobin says by claiming something from the past and misunderstanding what the church is trying to do now, especially since the teaching of the Catholic Church, when it's followed, and it has not been followed in so many cases, when we are faithful to the teaching of the Catholic Church, this is where the life of children thrive. When we listen to the words of Jesus, let these little ones come to me, and whoever causes these little ones to sin, it would be better if they had a millstone tied around their neck and they were thrown into the sea. If we were faithful to these teachings, this is where our children need to be. But then we look at the sociological evidence and the research being done for children who are, for example, cared for by same-sex couples or adopted by same-sex couples. While they may be in a loving environment, there's a lot of research coming out now that it's not healthy for the children, because then you would be forcing the children to have either not a father or not a mother. And while there seems to be some evidence and research out there done to prove otherwise, that's actually healthier or as healthy in those kinds of situations.
Those are very, very small sample groups, and right. Very limited questions are being asked.
Exactly. The research is methodologically not very sound.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I have to come back for a second. I know earlier in the last segment, Father Tim was talking about how he thinks maybe this tweet wasn't helpful from Bishop Tobin, that we agree 100%, but maybe not in a tweet in that setting. My thoughts are, I have to say, Father Tim, as being someone who is fighting this fight, and you are too, to hear strong statements sometimes from our pastors, it's going, okay, you are my leader. I am looking to you, and you are reminding me to be strong on this. It's a fortification for those who are struggling. I think, I don't know that Christ would have watered it down. I don't know if he'd necessarily send a tweet per se. He might get out there and give, a video. We have to think about modern means of communication as well. But, Father Tim, relating back to this, because I think this really does tie in. Here in the state of California, those may know over the years, we've seen multiple states really wanting to push priests to break the seal of the confessional. Now, here in the state of California, this proposed legislation has passed the Senate, and it's looking at making its way through small state assembly cabinets and then essentially go into a floor vote essentially before going to the governor's desk. This is a huge infringement upon religious liberty if our priests are forced to violate the seal of the confessional. Now, here is what the bill's been watered down to, if you want to say that, where priests would essentially only have to kind of tell on their fellow priests or kind of people who they work directly with. Originally, it was a requirement that they have to report all abuse, no matter who came into the confessional.
That's right. And looking at how this vote went about, 30-2 in the California Senate, which means there are at least 30 senators in California who obviously, it seems, have not talked to a Catholic priest or somebody who regularly goes to confession about what the confessional means, what the confessional seal means, the gravity of it, what it allows for as far as privacy between a person and God in that moment of ultimate vulnerability, offering sins in order to receive healing, that they simply haven't had the conversation in order to understand what it is they're trying to get us to break. They claim to have evidence that the seal of the confessional has led to the abuse scandal, that it is part of a systemic attempt to cover up. But there is no evidence Even the articles and the research that they have put forward to say that this is evidence that this is helping in the abuse of, you know, in the Catholic Church has not been real evidence, has not been real research. And to understand what the seal of the confessional does for the penitent, and also now in a sense how it protects the priest, is that if a person knows that the seal is going to be broken, they're probably not going to bring that most intimate moment of their life into the confessional. And so this will actually be taking away our opportunity to allow for healing, to invite that person outside of the confessional to come to us, to bring this to us, and so that we might bring a healing not to just themselves, but to the church. And so it's a gross misunderstanding of what the seal of the confessional is for.
And the purpose of confession is to bring about that sanctifying grace, to renew the bond between the person and God. The reality is that mortal sin destroys charity in us. It destroys grace. And so we have to renew that bond to God rather than being cut off from the base, right, of the branches. This is so important. And I think from a practical perspective as well, Father Tim, you know, just looking at this, we really in the church, it has established the ability and almost we could say even a right within the Catholic Church to a private confession, hence why we've implemented the ability for screens. So I think that, you know, so are they going to say now all confessions have to be face to face with a camera in the light of day? You know, the reality is I think a lot of priests are not even aware of who is confessing to them, especially when they're seeing confession after confession. But in addition to that, you know, we just have to look at this from the perspective as well of how so many people are looking for freedom from their sin. And yes, we need to discuss the harmful impact, but I know many priests who have shared with me, they hear something in the confessional, and whether it's a young person or an adult, I can't address this further outside of the confessional unless when the confession's over, you're willing to talk about this, because that would violate the seal of the confessional.
That's right. Even if somebody comes up to me after confession and would like to talk about what they shared in confession, I will ask them to share with me again, to say it out loud, what it is they want to talk about, because I do not want to step over that line of saying, okay, what did I hear in the confessional? What did I not? It's a matter of, I want to protect them. It's important for me to be protected as well, but not in the sense of, you know, trying to hide anything.
Right.
And so it's really important that even if that same person comes up to me outside the confessional, if they're like, remember what I said in the confessional the other day? I will say, I don't remember. And most often I do. I'm not lying most of the time. You know, and I'll say this because in a sense, sin is boring. Like, why would I want to remember these things, especially if I hear it over and over again? I'm not saying you're boring. I'm saying your sin is boring. Sin is not creative. It cannot create anything. It can only take away. Sin takes so much more than it ever gives. Mm-hmm. And so why would I want to remember that? And so if I hear something in the confessional, if it's some kind of abuse, somebody's going to be hurt or hurt someone else, often if it's a teen, I'll say something like, I really do not want to let you leave here unless you promise me that you're going to talk to somebody about this. And so I do everything I can to help them bring it into the light if that's going to bring healing. And forcing us or attempting to force us, they cannot force us to break the confessional seal.
We cannot limit God's grace. Right. And this is what's going to happen. If this passes, people will be afraid to go to confession. The reality is that already the Bishop Michael Barber of Oakland has already stated that all of his priests are not to comply if this bill passes and is made law in the state of California.
I'm so grateful for the strength of his words and the encouragement he gives to us priests, even though he's not my bishop, to hear a bishop come out that strongly, because those are the words I want to say. But I haven't heard my archbishop say the words that strongly, and so I don't want to step out of line quite yet. But he's been very encouraging to us, our own archbishop, to continue to fight against this and just to be faithful to our promises that we make and the seal of the confessional.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Hello, hello, everyone. I'm here with Father Tim Grumbach, and we've been talking about the challenges facing the seal of the confessional and state laws in California that are looking at the possible change, forcing priests into a violation of that sacred seal. I really want to remind all of you to be keeping an eye out for social action right now, to contact your senators, more so next the assembly members and governor, as laws such as this will continue to be brought forth, not just in California, but other states across the nation. nation, and we need you to speak up to defend religious liberty. And ultimately, it's a First Amendment right, and we need to remember that there's a separation between church and state that was established here to protect the sacred.
And I also want to call everyone to just a deep consideration of how ineffective this would be if it became law. How would one enforce it, other than to place people in the confessional in order to entrap a priest? Because then ultimately it would not be confession, and it would not be legal. So to enforce it is very problematic. And so just at a very practical level, we've got to get beyond this, get in touch with your representatives, with the assembly, with the governor, and let's just make it clear to them how impractical this is, along with the reality of the sacredness of the seal and the sacredness of our divine and intimate encounter with our loving God and his desire to bring us healing.
Coming up, we'll be talking about how to live in a state of grace. What does that look like, and why do we need to seek after it? In the meantime, a hardcore nerd alert. So I love reading books. I am a total fantasy book reader, and not the fantasies that some people think I'm referring to when I've shared that in the past. No, 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 I'm not going there. And one of my favorite authors of all time is David Eddings, and he has incredible series, a Belgariad series, a series with Sparhawk, and I've enjoyed and loved books such as Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. I'm not getting into that controversy today. You too, Father, love reading.
Oh, I love reading. I grew up as a Stephen King and Michael Crichton fan. I just was drinking that stuff in all the way through late elementary school and high school. And after high school, coming across, you know, Tolkien and Lewis and Chesterton and just all this great storytelling, inviting us into a fantasy world of sorts. And so, you know, maturing in the kind of books that I was reading is being invited into a fantasy world that tells us something about our world rather than simply horror and destruction and violence and sexuality, right?
One of the fun things with so many of the books that maybe from our childhood or even more currently, they're being made into movies and television shows. And it tells a story in another way. And I remember, you know, for example, when The Tudors came out, I think on HBO, it was a show that I really wanted to watch. I remember I tried to watch the first scene many years ago. And I mean, there's just so much absolute nudity that I shut it off and never watched it again. Game of Thrones was a show that sounded somewhat interesting to me, but from the get-go, I never even tried it because so much of the nudity that was present in it. Yet, Father Tim, it's been so difficult because so many really good faithful, even people high up in terms of working with the issues of sexual morality, justify watching shows like Game of Thrones or other shows with absolute porn in it.
Yeah, and there's some people who can, you know, in a certain sense, control themselves and go past these scenes and whatnot, and there are others who should not be entering into that, what is in reality a near occasion of sin. We're going to have to be honest about that, and each person is going to have to be able to do that examination of conscience and recognize, you know, watching this show is, you know, is, am I putting myself into this near occasion of sin? And ultimately also, what our entertainment helps us to do to grow in virtue.
I think we live in a time where you and I have talked a lot about this. We're so obsessed with almost like we view our ability like, oh, I can't believe I didn't have time to even watch a show this weekend. You know, we feel like we have this right to watch things and right, you know, to just lounge about. And I think with that attitude of watching and consuming so much media, we really begin to justify a lot of the medias that we're consuming. And I understand where people are coming from when they say, well, I can skip over this. I think that there are some movies where, you know, in advance, there's enough buildup, you could skip over a particular scene or two, depending on your technology. However, there are certain storylines, and I really believe Game of Thrones is one of them, where the story requires so much sexual perversity. I mean, I believe it's like half of the main female characters have been raped. There's incestuous relationships at the heart of the entire story. And the amount of nudity specifically directed at women is such a high level of expectation that I think to even watch the show is contributing to the expectation of nudity and sexual, you know, wrong sexual intimacy on TV.
I've been trying to give a certain language, the right words, the right terms to what it takes to watch shows like this, movies like this, to even take in books like this. And I've come to, we have to suspend our humanity to a certain extent. You know, I had been on Exodus 90 for the, you know, first few months of this new year. And so I wasn't watching any movies. I was reading a lot of theology, reading a lot of scripture. And then when I come out of it, I go see a few movies. The first one I saw was Hellboy, and it was just so much more violent and grotesque than the first couple of Hellboy movies. I mean, it's called Hellboy, right? I just saw John Wick 3. I'm a fan of that series, but then I realized you have to suspend a certain amount of belief and allow your imagination to run wild in order to keep up with the story and the violence. But then I walked out of it thinking, I was laughing nervously with everybody else in that theater at the most grotesque deaths in that movie. I had to suspend my humanity to enjoy that movie. And I think that's what we're really in danger of doing in taking in this kind of entertainment, is suspending our humanity, allowing people right in front of us in the stories and the entertainment that we take in, allowing people to, you know, be raped, for cities to be destroyed, for, you know, wholesale mass murder, and then just to be talking about it lightly the next day, as, you know, we don't want to be left out, right? We have the fear of missing out. We have the FOMO coming up. And in order to take care of that, we have to enter into this entertainment, which is, you know, causing us to suspend our humanity to a certain extent.
I think it's interesting how you tie in the issue of violence as well. I remember when the last Batman movie came out. Well, the original, not even original, Christian Bale Batmans, right? With The Dark Knight was the last one. And I remember talking to my mom after and saying, I'm having a hard time with the amount of violence. Like, it's a very violent movie.
Right.
I don't know that we should necessarily be having, you know, all of these kids watching this movie. My mom's usually, you know, pretty, you know, okay, there's some violence in a movie, not one to kind of shy away because of that. But I like where you talk about, you know, suspending our humanity, that when you get to the point where we're justifying something or uncomfortably laughing, we're supporting, especially within the realm of sexual immorality, because it's one thing to depict a scene of violence, but it's, that's totally fake. But it's another thing to physically have to engage in sexual intimacy and nudity in order to accomplish a storyline. And when we're watching these shows, we are paying into the necessity to accomplish these sexual scenes.
Right. And it's mixing together sexuality and violence, right, which is a terrible message.
Scenes.
Right. And just that the show involves violence at the level of war, but also violence at the level of sexuality. And we end up talking about, you know, it takes place on a, you know, people are watching it Sunday night after, you know, this is the day that we consider our Sabbath. It's a day to be resting. It's a day to enter into the Eucharist together, to be with our families. And then we begin the week anew. And this is how we begin our week anew. I've got some questions about that. I read all of the books. So obviously that gives me some authority, right? To have read the books. I haven't seen all of the shows. I've seen a couple of episodes. I know what happened at the end of the series. So we might as well, you know, offer a little spoiler alert here at the end of the series. Is what disturbs me the most is when somebody tries to create a Christian allegory out of something like Game of Thrones. One of the clearest was Father James Martin spoke about how Bran Stark, one of the characters from the very beginning of the show, who was right at the heart of the story being told right at the beginning and then kind of wove his way in and out of the story throughout the rest of the series, he ends up becoming the king of, you know, the Seven Kingdoms, well, six of the Seven Kingdoms. And Father James Martin points out, look, he's the wounded one. He, you know, he's paralyzed in like the first episode of the series. You know, the wounded one becomes king. Does this sound familiar? And he's trying to create this Christ-like image, this Christian allegory out of a show like Game of Thrones. And I know that every time Game of Thrones touches a Christian idea, a Christian storyline, a Christian element, it distorts and perverts it. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is look at the gods and the religions of Game of Thrones and understand, no wonder the image of the human person is so distorted, because the image of every one of these gods and religions in the story is a perversion of the Christian God, of the God revealed by Jesus Christ.
And that's where we get into a realm of good books versus and good stories versus not good stories necessarily. It's one thing to learn, read something for education, understand opposing points of views, for example. But I'm going to push back just a little bit, because I actually would not recommend reading Game of Thrones. I started the books.
I would not either.
I started the books and I think I maybe made it 20 or 30 pages in, and I actually was reading it, and my issue was actually with the author and the way it very descriptively violated the woman's body any time the author referred to looking at a woman, essentially. And I believe that goes through most of the series.
Yeah, and it actually violates the dignity of masculinity masculine sexuality as well.
By saying that that's just how men interact all the time. And grant, I think many men do struggle with that. But then when they're put into check, they're challenged to control themselves. You know, they're called to be better men. And so I actually completely returned it. I'm like, I'm going to burn this book, but I returned it, got my money back. I really just think that the storyline overall, the genre in way in which he writes, it's one thing to try and tell a historically accurate thing about the way women were violated and there was rape and there continues to be rape in our society, but it's another thing to also depict it and to constantly describe women in such a way.
And I remember reading a couple of articles in the LA Times a couple of days after the series ended, so just recently, lamenting that women weren't given greater empowerment by the end of the series. And my thought is, are you seriously looking to Game of Thrones as the place to find empowerment for women? You know, I've read through the series, I've read through the storyline of the TV show. Women are not empowered through this story. You know, you have some strong, powerful women figures, queens and warriors and people that, you know, in certain ways you could look up to them. But ultimately, Game of Thrones is not the place we should be looking for the empowerment of women.
Well, and doesn't that remind us that, sure, document history, but tell good stories that challenge us to grow, to change, come out of sorrow, come out of, you know, our own mundane lousiness to do what is good.
Timmery will be right back. Send her a tweet at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Father Tim Grumbach is in the studio with me, and we are talking about living in a state of grace. Why is it that we need to take this more seriously in our lives? The saints did, for some for many years, some through major conversions, some since they were little children, saw the importance of union with God. We're going to be talking about this coming up, and I really want to challenge you guys, pick your favorite episode of Trending, and please send a text message link to it to a friend. Maybe they're traveling over the weekend, maybe they have a long commute. Share Trending with other people. You can head over to radiotrending.com, go over to the guest page, maybe find some of your favorite episodes with our different guests like Father Tim Grumbach, who's with me today, Don Johnson, and others, and share that episode with those who you think will benefit. So, Father Tim, let's talk about this. What does it mean to live in a state of grace?
It means to live within the life of God that's being poured out into the world. Is that that's what grace is. You know, ultimately, yes, there's so many forms of grace and experiences of grace, but at its most fundamental sense, it's the life of God.
And we have to take this seriously, because one of the great messages that Christ came about to really clarify is the kingdom of God is at hand. He's saying the kingdom of God is at hand right now. Heaven on earth is present in the church and the ability to live the virtues, to live a virtuous lifestyle in union with God. And I love working, especially with young adults, because I have just the awesome opportunity to travel around speaking to many people who are taking ownership maybe of their faith for the first time. They're distinguishing their faith apart from their parents. They're living in truly a battleground in terms of so many of our public university campuses, in terms of thought, ideology, abortion, contraception, gender ideology. And there's a lot of challenges out there. And I remind so many young people, you guys, we are called to be saints here and now. But we've got to stop making excuses. And we have to remember that sanctifying grace means that we need to be holy. And to be holy means to be set apart. You know, Father Tim, I think of the Greek language, the word agios, right, in Greek, mm-hmm. and how that word is used for saints or holy people. And ultimately, this word agios in Greek essentially means to be set apart or different.
That's right. It's a sanctification, and it goes all the way back to the Old Testament experience of sanctification. You look at prophets like Isaiah, in which God is, you know, holy other. He is so holy and so separated that the angels will sing holy, holy, holy. And, you know, in that, you know, great and poetic and beautiful Hebrew language, that to repeat a word twice means to make, you know, it's better, but to repeat it three times, that's the greatest form of it. And so God's not just one holy thing among others, but he is, you know, holy beyond holy. And so when Isaiah, you know, sees, you know, his vision of the Lord in the temple, and his train fills the temple, and the smoke fills the temple, and the angels are singing, he is so worried about dying because he's coming up against that which is holy other. And so the sanctity and the grace of God pouring out in that moment is a terrifying thing because of how You know, it makes the temple tremble, and it makes Isaiah tremble, and then God purifies his lips in order to be able to take his words to his people.
I love that scene. And you look at the New Testament as well. For example, people might say, well, how is that even possible to live in a state of grace? Are we really supposed to live this out? And I say, just look at Scripture, Romans chapter 6, or turn to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And you go to Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 1987, and it right there cites St. Paul, where St. Paul says we're supposed to be dead to sin, but alive in God. That's living in a state of grace. We've gone through a period of purging, right, of conversion, and that's actually the natural process of the human person. We go from conversion into a sense of justification, right? And from there, we start to live a life of righteousness, living in what is right and good and true.
Yeah, St. Paul, especially in Romans 6, 7, and 8,
yes,
he points out that those who've been, those that God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, so that he might be the firstborn of many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called, and those he called, he also justified, and those he justified, he also glorified. So at the center of living this life of grace is being conformed to the image of the Son of God.
But notice how the whole time it's talking about what God is doing,
that's
what
right.
Christ is accomplishing in us. And so how do you live in a state of grace? We're called to cooperate in those graces that we are given at baptism. We receive the necessary grace to be with God in heaven. But when we sin, and again, sin is the only thing we do in and of ourselves, we separate ourselves from God. But that's why we read, it's by the power of the Holy Spirit, God working in our lives, if we are just open to receiving what, graces, and grace is an absolute gift that makes us sanctified.
Yeah, and to hear things like, you just want to become a better person, and that's how you earn grace by becoming a better person.
Be the best version of yourself.
Oh, I wasn't going to say that out loud, but you
on,
go
Father.
Ahead, right? Yeah, yeah. What I hope is at the center of that. I haven't studied that phrase enough to know, what's at the center of it.
He's cringing if you can see us on the live video right now on Facebook.
Eyes rolling into the back of my head, right? Yeah. What must be at the center of becoming the best version of yourself is conformity to the image of Christ, the Son of God. If you're going to become the best version of yourself, you have to be conformed to the image of Christ. And that means, like Paul says in Romans, is that, how are we who are dead to sin yet to still live in it? Are you unaware that we who are baptized into Christ are baptized into his death? For indeed, we have been buried in baptism into death, so that just as Christ was risen from the dead, so that we might too also live in the newness of life. For if we have grown in union with him into a death like his, we shall also be united with him in the resurrection.
Absolutely.
It's not about becoming a good person here on earth. It's about becoming Christ.
Yeah. Christosis. In theology, we read about Christosis, becoming like Christ, or theosis, where you're pouring everything you have out. And I think of the saints. For example, St. Gianna. I was just reading again about St. Gianna Mola, a very modern saint whose daughter, she died after giving birth to her child just, I think, within a few days or a couple weeks. I met the daughter. I have a picture. You can look at it on social media. But St. Gianna, she had specific things she did every day. She attended daily mass. She did a morning and night prayer on her knees. She did an examination of conscience. Like, these are things that we have to do. Pray your rosary daily. These are things for success. And she said, do all of these things. She also encouraged, we have to pray, meditate for a good 30 minutes per day. And I find this so true. When I don't take
unless you're
that
busy,
time,
right?
But that's the thing. If I don't make that time, I know that the way I interact during the day or throughout the week is thrown off. It's reconnecting our soul to God.
Yeah, and that's the great word of so many of the saints. Everybody must pray for half an hour or an hour. Unless you're busy, then you must pray for 2 hours, right? St. Augustine, I believe it is, that his little quip of work as if everything depends on you, but pray as if everything depends on God. And that we have this cooperation with the grace that God is pouring into the world is that, as Bishop Barron is always, correcting Martin Luther's sense of, sola fide, faith alone, or grace alone, sola gratia, is that, maybe grace first, it doesn't start anywhere but with grace. But what's required of us is a cooperation, is a, conformity to Christ's death and, his life, his death, his resurrection. So that, the life I live is no longer my own. I've been crucified with Christ. And we can't simply think that our Christianity is summed up by trying to be good people.
And the reality is stop making it so hard on yourself. If you recognize that by your baptism, and if you haven't been baptized, and maybe you're listening and you're not Catholic, or maybe you didn't believe in infant baptism and you were evangelical and you're listening, whatever it might be, be baptized. That's why we have infant baptism, because that gives you the grace by God to sanctify you so that you can cooperate. We still have free will even after baptism. We can freely choose to fall away from Him and go to hell, and that's the reality of it.
Yeah, look at the letter to the Romans, the letter to the Colossians, all through the Acts of the Apostles. They're assuming the people they're talking to are baptized or are about to get baptized. You know, the first letter of St. Peter. And then you'll come across some Christians who will claim that baptism is not necessary. It's simply the word of faith, mm-hmm. you know, saying that I believe in God and trusting Him, which is great. Do that. But let's be baptized into a community. We're not saved by ourselves. And you know, I remember coming back up the 5 one time back into LA and kind of going up into the Grapevine and seeing a sign on the side of the road was, is Christ in you? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I hope so. But I think the more important question is, am I in Christ? Because that's the language that is predominant throughout the letters of the New Testament, yes. especially in St. Paul. It's not so much he's talking about, is Christ in you? Do you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? All important. But what seems to be most important to this early church is that they are bound to one another in Christ. We just celebrated the Feast of the Ascension, the Solemnity of the Ascension, where Christ has taken our humanity up into heaven with Him. And that to be in Christ is to have a foot in heaven and a foot on earth. And we experience that in the sacraments, which are more than just a rite of passage. They are the ways in which God pours His grace, that we know that He pours His grace. He has assured us that He pours His grace into the world through the sacraments. You know, through baptism, we just said it. You know, through reconciliation, we've been talking about that in this episode as well, is that it's not just a venting and getting something off your chest, but it's an act of God is pouring grace in through the sacrament of matrimony makes holy even the daily struggles of a family. You know, the sacrament of holy orders takes very broken men and turns their hands and their voice into that of Christ's. You know, the anointing of the sick pours grace into the life of a sick person so that their very sufferings become an act of worship. And then the Eucharist itself gathers together all of our sufferings and our joys and pours grace into those moments. May not fix them the way that we want to, but to live a life of grace, we cannot avoid the sacraments.
And it requires taking ownership for your life. You know, I think of retired Navy SEAL Jocko Willink, and he's inspired so many people across the nation because he, I think, is speaking virtue. Take ownership for your lives and adding that Christian message. If you take ownership for your life, if you cooperate, this outpouring of grace that Father Tim's talking about will transform your life. And I want to really give a shout out and thank you to Father Tim, because you just celebrated your second anniversary as being ordained a priest here in the Diocese of Los Angeles. So from the bottom of my heart, I want to say thank you, because you're leading so many of us by your cooperation and God's grace.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's why I can speak so personally about the idea that God takes very broken men and takes their hands and their voices and makes them into His own.
Where can people find you again on social media, especially I think Instagram and Twitter, right?
Right, on Twitter, Father Tim Grumbach. And on Instagram, it's simply Father Tim Grumbach.
And if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Tim Ray, and I will link to Father Tim Grumbach on social media. Have a great week.
This has been Trending with Timmery. To learn more about Timmery Millington, visit timmery.com.